This podcast is brought to you by Shopify. Shopify is growing their team with offices and remote teams across the globe. Visit shopify.com/careers to learn more.
Do you have a joke?
I'm out of jokes.
How are you out of jokes?
Dude, like, I have like six jokes and I just repeat them all the time. That's how being a dad works.
You're my endless font of dad jokes.
Yeah, that I'd say over and over again because that's what makes them funny. Especially if you have to explain it afterwards.
Well, I think we have our intro.
There we go.
Hi, Sean.
Hi, Sam.
What have you been working on this week? What have I been working on this week? A lot of incident management. If you look at the DigitalOcean status page, you'll see that we've had a little bit of a choppy week on our cloud. Actually, a few weeks ago, I wrote a publicly available postmortem. So I've been thinking about from like how incidents begin through how you do good incident management and what like follow-up looks like a lot this week, both because I handle them myself, but also I manage people who handle them a lot now.
Yeah.
And that's been really interesting to work through. Sure.
So the ocean is on fire, is what you're saying.
I wouldn't go to that extreme of a degree, but we've definitely had an interesting couple of weeks. Let's put it like that. And yeah, I will say one of the things that I think is really interesting about doing incidents is how the like phases of an incident occur. So many times when I'm working with people, they're like, the incident begins at the point here on this like graph or logging stream when something went wrong. And I'm like, sure, but then we didn't notice for like 35 minutes. And so like there's like many phases to an incident, right? When the problem actually begins, when your observability notices, when you notice, when you try and reach out to someone to do something about it, when they actually start doing something about it, then like once you think you've fixed it, and then once everything tells you that you've actually fixed it, right? And documenting those and going through phase transitions and that sort of thing, and having a really good procedure around that is really important.
So does DigitalOcean have any sort of SLO?
We do. So the primary one is around Droplet. And I think we state that your droplets will be available 99.95% of the time.
Okay.
And that like we offer a credit. Frequently, though, for us, the problem is not that like a user's droplet is unavailable, but rather like it's something in our control plane, right? So like, you can't modify the state of your droplet, or like the control panel won't load. Or in the case of the incident that we sort of publicly described most recently, we had issues with support email flowing from point A to point B. And so we talked about that in a little bit of detail.
Yeah.
Right. And so for many of the things that you might consider sort of critical to our business function, we don't necessarily describe an SLA for that. We totally have internal SLOs around all of these things, and we do actually spend a reasonable degree of time making sure that we're trying to keep those things as reliable as we can.
Yeah, that sounds somewhat similar to the situation at Shopify, where most of our incidents tend to be things like your store is still up and checkout still works, but you can't add a new product or something like that.
Totally.
That can you know, definitely cause major problems for very specific customers if they're, for example, planning a flash sale right around the time an incident happens there.
Right. Do y'all do like canaries or smoke testing or anything? Like, is there a bot which adds a product to a shopping cart once a minute, every minute on a random store and like alerts very quickly?
I mean, I'm sure we have that for detection. I actually don't know specifically the details of that. When you said canary, I thought for a second you meant like a canary deploy.
Sure.
Which we do, but we only use it very rarely.
Gotcha. Yeah, so we internally have this term canary, which means system that is doing a full stack end-to-end test against our product.
Yeah.
And alerting people if it fails. So for example, our droplet team has the droplet canary, and like literally every minute it like spins off a new account, like adds a fake credit card, like makes a droplet, make sure the droplet creates correctly, SSHs it on both IPv4 and IPv6, and then burns it down, right?
Yeah.
The block storage team is attaching and detaching block storage volumes continuously. I believe our spaces and load balancers team have equivalent versions. But like the basic trick here is that it's not like flicking the API or doing something internal. Right. It's literally driving a fake browser through our control panel. And similarly for our API, using an API key to actually confirm that the DigitalOcean API is doing the right thing.
Yeah.
This is like really good for detection. So for us, like, we generally find that the duration of an incident does not vary too much once we've detected it. About, I know in the Google SRE book, they state that about 70% of their production incidents are related to some kind of production change that was made. I don't know what the same figure for us would be, but we can assume it's sort of similar, right? If that's the case, then usually the right answer is roll back as quickly as you can.
Yes.
And if you can roll back as quickly as you can, that usually helps you solve the problem.
Yeah, and that's one of the things we do every single pull request in our template. You even, like, for a lot of the changes that I make where I delete the majority of the template because it, you know, one of the things is I have checked for XSS vulnerabilities, which doesn't really apply to a lot of the refactoring stuff. But, you know, one of the ones that everybody always leaves in is it is safe to simply roll back this change.
Gotcha.
Because we have a big red button. If something goes wrong, you know, we definitely prefer a rollback to a revert since we don't have to build a new container.
Right. Gotcha. And yeah, we actually have the same idea. So our continuous delivery system lets us, basically the way that you actually do it is you replay the nth minus one production deploy stage. Like, there is no explicit rollback stage, but you can just you can play it again.
Right. No, and that's what I mean by rollback, as opposed to a revert where we added, you know, a new commit to switch back. There's no like anything happens that's rolling it back. It's literally just we deploy the previous container.
Yeah, we do exactly the same thing. Although it's really interesting for certain classes of incident, whoever's running it is totally at liberty to make a sort of like roll forward versus roll back determination.
Yeah.
So like, if you genuinely believe that you can fix the bug and get that out to production faster than doing the rollback deploy for whatever reason, or doing a rollback is not safe, we make that determination quite frequently, right?
Right.
And so it's not like a thou shalt always, but rather a like, this is a totally reasonable thing for you to do if you personally are able to make the decision that it's a good idea.
Yeah, I think we would only ever do that if it was unsafe, just because it's literally impossible for you to, even if you have the code committed immediately, it is impossible for a new container build to be able to deploy faster than an existing one.
I can believe that. Yeah, totally. That's not always true for us, but you'll have some interesting and different scale constraints, so I could totally believe that.
I think our containers are probably also just caching less stuff than yours might be.
Oh, Docker container caching. That's definitely a subject we should talk about on another day, because I could yell for hours about that. It's really interesting. Actually, one of the things I've been doing a lot recently in our incidents is doing on-the-fly composition of dashboards from like other teams' observability. Mm-hmm. So we use Grafana, and basically like what that means is every single team's dashboards is shared on a single Grafana instance. And one of the things it lets you do is like completely copy somebody else's graph into a new graph table, whatever it may be. Grafana has many visualizations, into a new dashboard. And so when we have incidents on sort of like shared infrastructure, it can be really useful to just like start grabbing stuff from other places to do correlation and actually show the like, say one team's alerts have gone off first and then another team's alerts go off and so on and so on. Like, it's nice to be able to quickly scope the failure into, is it our shared database? Is it one of our caching? So, like, where exactly in the infrastructure is this, where it may not be immediately obvious to a single team that it's actually not just them, but it's the entire platform that's having some issues, right? And then that allows us to upgrade the severity, call in an incident manager, and begin to change how we treat the incident. And so, like, one of the things we have is a really well-defined severity scale that tells us what kind of response is needed. And that's also been really useful for us.
Yeah. Yeah, it's similar. You know, so it was interesting. You were mentioning canary deploys earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Or not canary deploys, but a canary bot earlier.
Production smoke testing, canary system, like whatever you want to call it, right?
I'm just trying to think, because I'm not actually sure if we have anything specifically like that, but our traffic to storefront related stuff is so high around the clock, it's virtually impossible to break that without immediately finding out, unless it is something super, super subtle, like hardware failures that only affect one region. So only certain stores are affected and only some of the time.
Yeah. So that's totally valid. And we actually use, I mean, we combine our production smoke testing with a lot of metrics-based alerting as well. So
right.
If you average over a 20-minute window, how many droplet creates per second there are, that is basically just always 1.0 plus or minus 0.1, right? So like the number of droplet creates per second averaged over a 20-minute window basically never changes, right? There are big spikes and there are sort of little lulls in that, but like, that's a thing that we can sort of absolutely alert on, is if it's really high or if it's really low. And the high there meaning like we may be under attack or something may have gone wrong in our rate limiting infrastructure, right? And we actually have a similar, so my team works on our ticketing systems. We have a similar metric for tickets. I think it's something like 20 to 30 tickets every 5 minutes, like clockwork, no matter what the time of day is. And because like it doesn't change by time of day or in fact really day of week, those allow us to build some really great sort of core ground truth metrics that tell us like if this changes, it's likely not like the users, it's likely the platform, right? So we actually do a lot of this where we combine like functional metrics like response time and request throughput and queue depth and memory usage with, non-functional metrics like those with functional ones like how many droplet creates are we doing? How many credit cards are we processing? You know, yeah. And all of those. And a decline in either will trigger alerts that people can look at. We have a centralized logging team, and they actually have alerts both on like too many logs and not enough logs. Like if the logging volume goes below some minimal threshold, it's usually indicative of a networking failure, right? And actually, when we do have networking failures, you can tell pretty quickly because like members from every single team show up in our escalations channel and are like, hey, my service is reporting down, right? Yeah.
Yeah, we've been adding more metrics to crates.io, that's one of the things that we've been looking at is, you know, we had a lot of non-functional metrics to start just because Heroku gives you those for free.
Right.
We had an incident the day before RustConf where a deploy made it impossible to publish a new crate.
Totally.
And the way that ended up manifesting was they would get a 404, but crates are deployed so infrequently it was not enough to trigger an alert on our 4xx percentage. You know, that it's once every 5 minutes roughly, whereas every minute we get 5 or 6 404s from crawlers looking for insecure WordPress installations.
Totally.
And so finding things like, okay, so just alerting because we have an increased 4xx rate is not going to be enough there, but definitely if no crates are published within 20 or 30 minutes, that's definitely something that we can pretty easily alert on.
Right. And that's where you could imagine having a crate canary as well, right? Like,
yes.
Have a bot which tries to upload a crate once every 5 minutes, and if that bot fails, like, immediately wake everyone up, like, tweet, like, set the status page to red, like, fire the cannons, like, everything is broken, crates are broken, oh my god.
Yeah.
It's really interesting as well, I think, because, like, even once you've got your detection really snappy, right, be it droplets aren't creating, or crates aren't uploading, or whatever it is, then you've just got to deal with the whole process of actually, like, managing and fixing your incident, right?
Right.
And like we have a lot of people involved in any particular incident at DigitalOcean. So at minimum, we'll have a member from our cloud operations team, which is our sort of like 24/7 world-class Linux sysadmins. If anyone on my cloud ops team is listening, I love you. You save me so much sleep. I can't even begin to describe. And then usually members of our support team who are managing messaging, customer impact, engineers, possibly multiple, and like then sort of other people who are interested, right?
Yeah.
And like it's usually the responsibility of like the cloud ops member to triage and hand off the incident, and then the one engineer who got paged in first to run it until they either hand the ball to somebody else or like the incident is resolved. And one of the things that I try to do whenever this happens is just communicate like aggressively frequently in Slack as to what I'm doing,
right?
Like way more than I would ever like do under normal things, like even down to like, okay, I've written the code, I'm like committing it now, I'm pushing it, you know, that sort of thing. Here's what the metrics look like. Hey, other person, how's the state of this look, you know, those sorts of things. And I think a lot of people, especially when they're newer to this, can sort of focus in on fixing the problem and not like talking to others about what's going on, which is right. actually almost as important in a situation like this.
Well, especially your customers.
Right, exactly.
So I think that's the single most important thing, right, is updating your status page. And if it's going to be a major customer facing impact, paging support and getting people woken up to handle the increased queue.
Yeah, so it's actually really interesting that you say that, because our severity scale also defines how we communicate with our customers. So we actually, depending on size of customer impact, we basically either do or do not post a status page, and also like duration, right? There's like some classes of incident where it's easier for us to do individualized communications with customers than it is for us to like throw up a status page and do communication like that, because it may actually cause more panic than it causes help, right?
Right.
Like, if this is not a real incident that actually happened, this is totally a straw man. But if, like, only load balancers in the second layer 2 zone in Frankfurt are not working, that's probably not worth a status page, because it's, like, less than 100 customers total, right? If it's, like, this entire data center is offline, yes, of course, a status page is going up.
Yeah, no, and I think we have I'm actually looking right now, we have a similar thing where depending on what percentage of whatever metric has triggered is being affected, whether or not we will update the status page.
Totally. And I mean, you can look at the DigitalOcean status page for examples of where we have and haven't done those for sure. But yeah, like the way that we actually usually handle that is our communications team, which also deals with like press releases and product announcements and that sort of thing, hold the pager. And we actually have real communication staff writing our status pages on our behalf, which I think is a really good way of handling that. That team also does the sort of final treatment on any public postmortems that we write. So I'm not the best at writing the English language. It's not. it's a skill that has taken a backseat to writing mountains and mountains of Ruby over the years. And so it's really nice to have them to be able to lean on when that sort of thing happens. Our internal postmortem process is actually, I think, one of the places where this whole management framework really shines. We've actually had for the last more than a year at this point, an internal person whose job it is just to entirely like standardize this process. And so we've actually built a really great mature process around it. I think it's gotten a lot better. But our postmortem, we start by filling out a timeline, and that's just everything that happened. And it's also, as it stands today, a fairly laborious process because it involves copy-pasting lines out of Slack into a Google Doc, along with like links to GitHub, links to metrics, links to logging, and that sort of thing. But also, because logs and metrics rotate out, frequently screenshotting and preserving those things so that like the document will still be valid a year later. And that's like the most time-consuming part of our process for sure. Like, That can take, like, even for a small scope incident, that can take like an hour or two to get correct, just because there's like so much context that you have to reconstruct. Then we sort of, we try to do what went well, what went poorly. These are comments on sort of how incident response itself was conducted rather than like the wider situation. And then we have a situation called root cause, which I have like strong feelings about, because I think the term root cause is a total misnomer. It indicates to the person filling it out that there is like a single cause for a thing, and that like quite frequently people take it to mean like explain the bug that occurred, right? And like I've always taken that to mean like what are the procedural, policy, systemic, HR, training, organizational issues that enabled this incident to be possible.
Well, right? they're sometimes technical too, right? If the root cause was that this deploy had a commit which had a bug in it, then, I mean, it's not an HR or a policy problem. It's literally like, why didn't the test suite catch it?
Well, sure. But that's what I mean when I sort of say systemic or organizational failures, right? Because like that engineer probably like wasn't trying to deploy bad code, right? And like—
One would hope.
And there's like a reasonable probability that that person even wrote tests. Like, people generally try to write tests, or at least the people I work with.
One would hope.
sorry, my team. I'm sorry I didn't write tests. so it's like, well, so presumably that went through a code review. What about the code review process, like, didn't, like, find the bugs? Mm-hmm. What in your staging environment didn't enable you to catch this bug before it made it all the way through to production, right? Like, why are your staging metrics not, like, causing you to be unable to deploy this to production, right? Like, there's a whole host of deeper questions you can ask there that actually really aren't all that technical, right? Like, there's a, like, that bug exists in a wider system, and, like, you should always be asking, what about this system could we change to make it harder to get that out the gate? And this is, like, the sort of problem here is that you're trying to extrapolate the future from data points, right? But, like, there are classes of, classes of failure are very common, right? And so really, really spending some time thinking about those classes of failure after you see an individual incident, I've found is really valuable. And so, like, one of the things I try to measure myself against is how frequently is my team getting paged? And that has generally tended to move downwards as time has gone on. And I think that's because we're taking the time to ask ourselves these hard questions. But yeah, like, I really like to dig in when people say that this cause is technical and ask, like, are you sure? Is it genuinely, like, are you certain? Because there's almost always a cultural aspect to everything that we're doing as software engineers. So, like, it's usually not purely technical. Also, that was one hell of a soapbox rant. I'm sorry.
So have you ever had to deal with an incident that was customer facing to a degree that even just a public postmortem isn't enough? Like, not even creating droplets was down, but droplets themselves were going down for an extended period of time. Have you ever had to deal with an incident like that?
So never directly. I think the classes of incidents where that has happened is when we've had networking issues in our data centers, right? And usually it's not my responsibility to be directly involved with those because I'm on, like, an applications team, right?
Sure.
Sort of like applications SRE team is how I would describe what my group does. But that doesn't mean, like, every single one of my services isn't impacted by those networking issues, right? And so I have to sort of watch it unfold. And so typically at that point, I am there to deliver observability or wait. Right.
Right.
So I will say that I think one of the parts of our incident management culture that's really good is that if an incident is severe enough, there's an incident manager on call who is usually a director or a VP in our various sort of engineering leadership layers. And that person will quite happily accept you dumping extra information at them to help them understand what's going on.
Right.
And so where the really, really bad incidents have happened, I've been fortunate enough not to be directly involved. That's generally the case. I guess there is one caveat to that, and this is an incident that we talked about pretty publicly, which was in April of 2017, where we dropped our production primary database.
Oops.
There's a public postmortem there, and I was sort of the tech lead for the team that turned out to be responsible for that.
Oops.
That was not a fun day for anyone.
Yeah.
So that's publicly documented. And in fact, I've given a talk about that I believe there is a video online for from the New York City Ruby user group, which is, and the talk was called Runway Overrun. So I'm sure we'll link that in the show notes and people can take a look if they're interested.
Yeah. It's one of the things that's interesting about incident management at Shopify. There tends to be a lot of customer communication that happens afterwards if it impacted storefronts or checkout in any meaningful way. Just because if either of those two things are down, I don't think there are any specific numbers I can share, but, like, our customers lose a mind-boggling amount of money per second.
Right.
So there needs to be a very high degree, if it's anything that could degrade our customers' trust in us, there needs to be a lot of communication that happens afterwards.
Absolutely. And I mean, yeah, we very frequently talk about these incidents, both not just on our status page, but if it's bad enough on our blog. When, I guess saying very frequently is probably not the right way to describe that.
Right.
But you when these things happen, it is common practice for us to state these things on our blog or status page. We issue service credits very liberally, right? Because we are a cloud hosting provider, the thing you are buying from us is uptime, right?
Right.
Like, literally, we are in the business of selling you uptime. So downtime is very bad. And so we try not to have it as frequently as possible. And we definitely do our best to make things right when there are issues.
And that's just the thing that makes certain incidents so high pressure for us is that, I mean, we can comp them whatever, you know, whatever's possible, but there's no way that we can comp the lost customers during downtime.
Right, exactly.
I hate being on call.
I actually really enjoy it. I've dealt with my fair share of incidents while working at DigitalOcean. There are a few reasons why I really like it. The first is, like, it lets me know the pain that, like, the customers are experiencing in a really visceral way, right? And that also, like, it's up to me to fix it. It's also the case that, like, it usually exposes the best parts of people's personalities because everyone is in there to try and get through it together as quickly as possible. But it also gives you a really good opportunity to demonstrate sort of, like, deeper issues with your organization I was talking about earlier. And so, like, when I'm sort of talking to engineering directors, engineering VPs at DigitalOcean about when incidents happen, I've found that they're very open and receptive to, like, making sure that we culturally fix the problems, right?
Yeah.
And so, like, when I say I like being on call, I hate being woken up at 3 o'clock in the morning by my phone going off because something is horribly wrong. But I know I'm probably going to get an opportunity to fix the problem. And that, like, as an engineer, I think that really psychs me out because fundamentally that's kind of what we're hired to do.
Right. Well, so for me, like, the reason that I'd say I don't like it is not so much because I have an issue with getting woken up at 3 a.m, but more just it really stresses me out because I'm not on any individual product team at Shopify. So I'm not, like, the on call for anything I can fix. Generally speaking, I'm on the IMOC rotation. So I'm the person who has to figure out who the right person to page is if they haven't already been paged.
Gotcha. So IMOC rotation is only engineering directors and VPs and no contributors or managers.
So for us, that's stage 2 IMOC. And that's one of the things that you determine as IMOC is, does this need to get, does this need to page a director?
Yeah. And so for us, we only have 3 classes of pageable incidents, Sev 2, Sev 1, and Sev 0. Sev 2, the CloudOps team that I mentioned earlier will make a best guess determination as to who needs to get paged and page that directly. So they sort of function as the stage 1 IMOC at that point.
Right.
And CloudOps is a 24/7 team that works in 3 shifts, which means you're always getting, like, that person is always fresh, right? They're at worst 8 hours into their working day. And so, like, they're usually able to make a pretty good decision about that. We also have tools like service catalogs and registries, etc., to help them make the right decision. And then, like, if for any reason on a Sev 2 they don't, you know, we have a pretty decent ability to just page in whoever we need to get an incident solved. And then for Sev 1s and Sev 0s, that's when those directors and VPs get called in. And, like, that's things like all Droplet creates are failing is, like, instantly a Sev 1, right? Or a whole data center being, like, and then Sev 0 is a large, complex global outage that would, like, end the business if something was not done about it quickly.
Right.
In the entire time the severity scale has existed, there have only been 2 Sev 0 incidents. Yeah.
Yeah, we have a similar-ish scale. I don't think we give them actual numbers like that, but the thing that would be the equivalent of Sev 0, from my understanding, there have been 3 in the history of Shopify.
Yeah.
Which is a reasonable number over the course of 12, 13 years, however long it's been around.
Yeah, totally. I mean, those incidents are infrequent and, like, usually are dealt with by dozens of engineers across the company banding
right.
together to do, like, a lot of work very quickly, right?
I am interested, you mentioned that you have this team work in 3 shifts, because that sounds, I guess your teams are very remote and distributed, right?
Yes.
So is the reason that you're able to do that because you have people in sufficiently distributed time zones, or are there actually people working for you in North America who have just committed to living their life on a go to sleep at 8 a.m.?
Yes. So the answer is both, actually.
Okay.
So we have offices in India and Singapore as well. So some of the people on those sort of late shift teams are based out of there. Some people on those teams just like working through the night and then having their day to have their day, right? So,
like, you gotta sleep sometime.
Right, exactly. I mean, but, you know, work through the night and then enjoy 8 hours of uptime and then sleep for 8 hours.
Sure.
I mean, I honestly don't know how they live their lives, but...
that's just what I'm thinking. That sounds like it would be very hard to hire for if you weren't across the world.
Yeah, and I mean, for example, some people on our second shift, which is 4 p.m. Eastern to midnight Eastern, live in sort of California, the, you know, the minus eight time zone, and so it doesn't affect them quite as much, right?
Right.
We also have, you know, European presence as well as that sort of Asian presence. So, like, and in fact, it's quite common for us. So not only is CloudOps structured like this, but support and our trust and safety teams also are 24-hour teams.
Yeah.
And we have a lot of people in our Indian offices who work our third shift, which is midnight Eastern to 8 a.m. Eastern from India, right? And so that's kind of how we deal with that problem is... being a global company, both in the sense that we have data centers all over the world and we have people all over the world.
Yeah, and support for us definitely works that way as well, leading to, for all hands, very expensive travel.
Yeah, so, I mean, like, I don't know how the CloudOps team came to be, but they're actually an incredibly effective tool in our arsenal to help engineers not receive pages. So because that sort of, like, they themselves are fairly technical and used to operating systems, we have a mechanism where we can hand them playbooks for, like, how to deal or triage with incidents in our systems, right? So, like, this metric has fallen off a cliff. Like, try restarting this service. Try flushing this cache.
Have you tried turning it off and back on again?
We frequently hand CloudOps playbooks that say, please try restarting this service.
Oh, no, absolutely.
On our behalf.
It's completely reasonable for us to try. I just think it's so funny how frequently that actually ends up being what you need to do.
And so I sometimes wake up at 9 o'clock, look at my team Slack channel, and discover that, like, CloudOps has executed a playbook for us overnight and saved us from taking an incident. Right. So, like,
yeah,
that's like a really useful tool that we have at our disposal. They basically operate by a few rules, though. The first is that, like, you have to wire this into an alert. Secondly, the playbook has to be mechanical. So it can't be like, go look at this graph and see if it looks normal, because they have to operate all the services at the company, so they don't really know what normal, like, they don't have enough context necessarily to know what normal looks like. And so it's more like, if the level is above this or below this, take this specific action. And then, like, they can't do all the things. You have to make sure they're, like, reasonably well placed to operate. So, like, credentials or can run a script or something similar, right? It's usually not like, go click through 100 web pages to solve our problem, because they're also dealing with all the other machines and all the other alerts in the fleet, right?
Right. It sounds like a really cool team. I'm just thinking we should have something similar to that at Shopify, which historically we wouldn't have been able to, just because, right, our offices are in Ottawa, Toronto, Waterloo, Montreal, all Eastern time zone. As we've been growing, we're really starting to become a much more distributed and remote friendly company. And so as we're getting more remote employees, I wonder if having something similar at Shopify will start to become feasible.
Yeah, it's totally great if your company can support this. I'm like, I never want to go back to being on call without a 24-hour operations team to deal with problems for me first, because it's so nice.
Yeah.
But, like, it's not every company. So firstly, not every company is large enough to support this, right? And then secondly, not every company is designed to work remotely and so could support something like this anyway, right? But it's totally something I will evangelize as being great as an engineer, because it means that if I'm dealing with an incident, it genuinely requires creative synthesis of what's going on. And so it's a way that we can sort of alleviate stress on our teams.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, in Shopify, we're over 3,000 people, so we're definitely big enough to support a team like that.
Absolutely. And so, I mean, some of it, as you sort of mentioned, might require a cultural shift, right? And then it needs someone to advocate for it internally as well, if it doesn't already exist.
Well, and it needs remote employees if you don't want to try and find people who are willing to work on very, very strange sleep schedules. I mean, it's possible to find people who will do that. They exist, but that sounds unreasonable to ask of employees unless they ask to do it specifically, I think.
Right, exactly. And yeah, that's definitely a thing where, like, I would never want to force somebody into that. I mean, kind of part of the culture at DO is that, like, we're very, very flexible on hours anyway, right? And it's actually interesting. We're flexible on hours for everyone apart from the shifted teams who have their, like, exactly aligned shifted. But the nice thing about those teams is, like, they are never asked to do, like, on-call or, like, extraordinary out-of-hours work unless, like, something truly, truly scary is happening. And so, like, there's a sort of flip side trade-off there. But I think it's really great. I've heard from people who do the work that they enjoy it. So I think it's a fun and good program. So I basically just wanted to say, hello, DigitalOcean customers. I know we've been talking about a lot of incidents and stuff, but like, DigitalOcean is a generally very stable platform, and this is more just my experiences with dealing with it. Please don't be scared by the discussion that we've just had. I promise you it's great.
Incidents happen everywhere.
Incidents happen everywhere, and if you're an engineer listening to this podcast, I'm sure you'll understand some of the stuff we've been talking about.
Let's wrap up?
Yes, absolutely.
Show notes for this episode can be found at yakshave.fm/2.
As always, rating and reviews on iTunes are much appreciated.
If you have feedback on this episode or any of our other episodes, you can email us at hosts@yakshave.fm, tweet us @_yakshave, or leave a comment on the website.
Thanks for listening to The Yak Shave, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks to Shopify for sponsoring this episode of Yak Shave. Shopify is leveling the playing field for entrepreneurs, building products that help anyone with a great idea build a successful business. And they're adding to their world-class team across the globe. Visit shopify.com/careers to find out how they work.